The Cat of Bubastes by G. A. Henty. Chapter 1. The King of the Rebu. The sun was blazing down upon a city on the western shore of the Caspian Sea. It was a primitive city, consisting of a vast aggregation of buildings which were for the most part mere huts. Among them rose a few of more solid build and of higher pretensions, the abodes of the chiefs and great men, the temples and places of assembly, and although larger and more solidly built, these were yet little more than magnified huts. The town was surrounded by a lofty wall, with battlements and loopholes. The streets were alive with the busy multitude. Most of the men wore helmets closely fitting to the head and surmounted by a spike, which were for the most part composed of hammered brass, although some were made of tough hide studded with knobs of metal. All carried round shields, those of the soldiers of leather stiffened with metal, and those of the captains of brass worked with considerable elaboration. In their belts all wore daggers, while at their backs were slung quivers of iron. Painted bows hung over one shoulder, and some had at their waist a pouch of smooth flat stones and leather slings. Their chief garment was a sort of kilt, falling to the knee. Above the waist some wore only a thin vest of white linen, others a garment not unlike a nightgown, but with short sleeves. The kilt was worn over this. Some had breast pieces of thick leather. In the case of the officers, the leather was covered with small pieces of metal, forming a sort of chain-linked armor. All carried two or three javelins in the left hand, and a spear some 10 feet long in the right. Horsemen galloped about at full speed to and from the royal palace, while occasionally chariots dashed along. These chariots were small, the wheels not exceeding 3 feet in height, and just large enough for two men to stand on. The males of the city were upon the point of marching out on a military expedition, a war on which the safety of the city depended. Inside the palace the bustle of preparation was as marked as without. The king and his principal counselors and leaders were assembled in the great circular hut which formed the audience room and council chamber. The king himself was a tall and warlike figure. He had led his warriors on many successful expeditions far to the west, and had repulsed with great loss the attempts of the Persians to encroach upon his territory. Standing behind him was his son, Amuba, a lad of some 15 years of age. The king and his counselors wore, in addition to the kilt and linen jacket, a long robe highly colored and ornamented with fanciful devices. It was fastened at the neck with a large brooch, and all wore a profusion of necklaces, bracelets, and other ornaments of gold. Many of the chiefs wore feathers in their helmets, and the greater portion of all ranks had figures tattooed on their arms and legs. They were fair in complexion, with blue eyes. Their hair was, for the most part, golden or red, and they wore their beards short and pointed. The young Prince Amuba was attired for the field. His helmet was of gold, and his armor covered with plates of the same metal. After listening for some time to the arguments of his elders, he retired to the large hut adjoining the council chamber. It was divided into several apartments. In one of these a lady was seated on a low couch covered with panther's skins. "They are not done yet talking, mother. It has been a question as to where we shall assemble to give battle. They have fixed upon a place at last. It's about 15 miles from here. You think we shall beat them, don't you, mother?"
"I hope so, Amuba."
"But we have several times repulsed them when they have invaded our country, mother. Why should we not do so this time?"
"They are much stronger than they have ever been before when they have come against us, and their king is a great warrior."
"I cannot think why he wants to conquer us, mother. They say the riches of Egypt are immense. We have no quarrel with them if they will let us alone."
"No country is so rich that it does not desire more, my son. We have gold, and are skilled in the working of it, and no doubt they anticipate that they will capture much treasure in the land. As to their having no quarrel with us, well, have we not made many expeditions to the west, returning with captives and much booty? And yet the people there had no quarrel with us. Some day, my son, things may be managed differently. But at present, kings who have power make war upon people that are weaker than themselves, spoil them of their goods, and make slaves of them. I hope, Amuba, you will not expose yourself too much in the conflict. It will doubtless be a terrible battle. I am terrified. Hitherto, when your father has gone out to battle, I've never doubted as to the result. The Persians were not foes whom brave men need dread. But the Egyptians are terrible foes, and the arms of their king have been everywhere victorious. My heart is filled with dread at the thought of the approaching conflict. I cannot think, mother, that our men will give way when fighting for their homes and country, upon ground chosen by themselves. I hope not, Amuba, but there is the trumpet sounding. Your father is about to start. Bless you, my dear boy, and may you return safe and sound from the conflict. The queen fondly embraced her son, and a few minutes later the king with his captains started from the palace. The charioteer of Amuba was a tall and powerful man named Jethro, who had been specially selected by the king for this service. Jethro's orders were that he was not to allow Amuba to rush into the front line of fighters, and that he was even to disobey the orders of the prince if he wished to charge into the ranks of the enemy.
"My son must not shirk danger," his father said, "and he must go well into the fight, but he is still but a boy. In time I hope he will fight abreast of me, but at present you must restrain his ardor. I need not bid you shield him as well as you can from the arrows of the Egyptians. He is my eldest son. If aught happens to me, he will be the king of the Rebu, and his life is therefore a precious one."
In 2 hours the king arrived at the appointed place, where already some 40,000 men were assembled. The scouts who had been sent out reported that the main body of the Egyptians would not be up in time to attack before dark. This was welcome news, for before night the rest of the forces of the Rebu, fully 30,000 more, would have joined. The king at once set out to examine the ground chosen by his general for the conflict. It sloped gently down in front to a small stream, which ran through soft and marshy ground, a formidable obstacle to the passage of Egyptian chariots. The right rested upon a dense wood, while a village 1.5 miles distant from the wood was held by the left wing. A causeway which led from this across the marsh had been broken up, and heavy blocks of stone were scattered thickly upon it to impede the passage of chariots. The archers were placed in front to harass the enemy attempting to cross. Behind them were the spearmen in readiness to advance and aid them if pressed. The chariots were on the higher ground in the rear, ready to dash in and join in the conflict should the enemy succeed in forcing their way through the marsh. The visit of inspection was scarcely finished when a cloud of dust was seen rising over the plain. The flash of arms could be seen in the sun, and presently a vast number of horses were seen approaching.
"Are they horsemen, father?" Amuba asked.
"No, they are chariots, Amuba. The Egyptians do not, like us, fight on horseback. Although there may be a few small bodies of horsemen with the army, their strength lies in their chariots."
The chariots drew up in perfect line, and as the clouds of dust blew away, 4 lines of chariots could be made out, ranged at a distance of 100 yards apart.
"There are about 1,000 in each line," the king said, "and this is but their advance guard. We have learned from fugitives that there are fully 15,000 chariots with their army. The main army are at hand. Do you see that great cloud against the setting sun? That is the dust raised by their advance. In another hour, they will be here."
The front line was ordered to remain under arms for a time. The others were told to fall out and prepare their food for the night. Great fires were lighted, and a number of oxen, which had been driven forward in readiness, were slaughtered for food.
"If the Egyptians can see what is going on," the king said to his son, "they must be filled with fury, for they worship oxen."
"Is it possible, father, that they can believe that cattle are gods?" Amuba asked in surprise.
"They do not exactly look upon them as gods, my son, but as sacred to their gods. Similarly, they reverence the cat, the ibis, and many other creatures."
"How strange," Amuba said. "Do they not worship the sun, which, as all must see, is the giver of light and heat, which ripens our crops and gives fertility and abundance?"
"Not so far as I know, Amuba, but I know that they have many gods who they believe give them victory over their enemies."
"They don't always give them victory, since four times they have been repulsed in their endeavors to invade our land. Perhaps our gods are more powerful than theirs."
"It may be that, my son. But so far as I can see, the gods give victory to the bravest and most numerous armies. But we know little of the ways of the gods. We have but to do our part bravely, and we need assuredly not fear the bulls and the cats and the other creatures which the Egyptians trust."
Some hours were spent by the king, his leaders, and his captains in going about among the troops, seeing that all the contingents had arrived well armed and in good order, and doing all in their power to encourage the soldiers. When all was done, the king sat down and talked with his son, giving him advice as to his conduct in future, if aught should befall him in the coming fight.
"You are my heir," he said. "Were I to survive for another 8 or 10 years, you would, of course, succeed me. But should I fall tomorrow, and should the Egyptians overrun the land, things may happen otherwise. In that case, the great need of the people would be a military leader who would rouse them to prolonged resistance. For such work, you are far too young, and the people would look to Amusis or one of my other captains as their leader. Should success crown his efforts, they may choose him as their king. In that case, I would say, Amuba, it will be far better for you to acquiesce in the public choice than to struggle against it. A lad like you would have no prospect of success against a victorious general, the choice of the people. I can assure you, there is nothing so very greatly to be envied in the lot of a king. And as one of the nobles of the land, your position would be far more pleasant here than as king. Do all in your power to win the good will of whoever may take the place of leader at my death, by setting an example of prompt and willing obedience to his orders. It is easy for an ambitious man to remove a lad from his path, and your safety absolutely demands that you shall give him no reason whatever to regard you as a rival. I trust that all this advice may not be needed, and that we may conquer in tomorrow's fight. But if we are beaten, the probability that I shall escape is very small, and it is therefore as well that you should be prepared for whatever may happen. If you find that in spite of following my advice the leader of the people is ill-disposed towards you, collect as large a band as you can, and journey with them to the far west, as so many of our people have done before, and establish yourself there and found a kingdom. None of those who have ever gone in that direction have returned, and they must therefore have found space to establish themselves."
His father spoke so seriously that Amuba lay down that night on his couch of skins, in a very different mood to that in which he had ridden out. He had thought little of his mother's forebodings, but his father's tone showed him that he, too, felt by no means confident of the issue of the day. As soon as daylight broke, the Rebus stood to their arms, and an hour later dense masses of the Egyptians were seen advancing. As soon as these reached the edge of the slope and began to descend towards the stream, the king ordered his people to advance to the edge of the swamp and to open fire with their arrows. A shower of missiles flew through the air and fell among the ranks of the Egyptian footmen, who had just arrived at the edge of the swamp.
So terrible was the discharge that the Egyptians recoiled, and retreating halfway up the slope where they would be beyond the reach of the Rebu, in turn discharged their arrows. The superiority of the Egyptian bowmen was at once manifest. They carried very powerful bows, and standing sideways drew them to the ear, and shot their arrows a vastly greater distance than did their opponents, who were accustomed to draw their bows only to the breast. Scores of the Rebu fell at the first discharge, and as the storm of arrows continued, they retired halfway up the side of the slope. Now, from behind the lines of the Egyptian archers, a column of men advanced, each carrying a bundle of branches. Again the Rebu advanced to the edge of the swamp and poured in their shower of arrows, but the Egyptians, covering themselves with the bundles of branches they carried, suffered little harm, while the Rebu were mown down by the arrows of the Egyptian archers, shooting calmly and steadily beyond the range of their missiles. As soon as the front rank of the Egyptian column reached the edge of the swampy ground, the men of the front line laid down their branches in a close row and then retired. Each rank, as it arrived at the edge, did the same. Many fell beneath the arrows of the Rebu, but the operation went on steadily, and the Rebu saw the gradual but steady advance of a causeway 200 yards wide across the swamp. The king himself and his bravest captains, alighting from their chariots, went down among the footmen and urged them to stand firm. Their entreaties, however, were in vain. The hail of the Egyptian arrows was so fast and deadly that even the bravest shrank from withstanding it. At last even their leaders ceased to urge them, and the king gave the order for all to fall back beyond the range of the Egyptian arrows. Some changes were made in the formation of the troops, and the best and most disciplined bands were placed facing the causeway so as to receive the charge of the Egyptian chariots. The two front lines were of spearmen, while on the higher ground behind them were placed archers whose orders were to shoot at the horses and pay no heed to those in the chariots. Then came the Rebu chariots, 400 in number. Behind these again was a deep line of spearmen. On the right and left, extending to the wood and village, were the main body of the army, who were to oppose the Egyptian footmen advancing across the swamp. When the last portion of the causeway was completed and the workmen had retired, the king leaped from his chariot and, leading a body of 100 men carrying blazing brands, dashed down the slope. The Egyptian archers ran forward and a storm of arrows was poured into the little band. 2/3 of them fell ere they reached the causeway. The others applied their torches to the branches. The Egyptian footmen rushed across to extinguish the flames, while the Rebu poured down to repel them. A desperate fight ensued, and the Egyptians were driven back. Their attack, however, had answered its purpose, for in the struggle the faggots had been trodden deeper into the mire, and the fire was extinguished. The Rebu now went back to their first position and awaited the attack, which they were powerless to avert. The long line of Egyptian footmen opened, and their chariots were seen, 50 abreast. Then, with a mighty shout, the whole army advanced down the slope. The Rebu replied with their war cry. At full speed, the Egyptian chariots dashed down to the causeway. This was the signal for the Rebu archers to draw their bows, and in an instant confusion was spread among the first line of chariots. The horses, wounded by the missiles, plunged madly, and many fell, but the Egyptian footmen opened such a terrible fire with their arrows that the front line of the Rebu were forced to fall back, and the aim of their archers became wild and uncertain. In vain the king endeavored to steady them. While he was doing so, the first of the Egyptian chariots had already made their way across the causeway, and behind them the others poured on in an unbroken column. Then, through the broken lines of spearmen, the Rebu chariots dashed down upon them, followed by the host of spearmen. The king's object was to arrest the first onslaught of the Egyptians, to overwhelm the leaders, and prevent the mass behind from emerging from the crowded causeway. The shock was terrible. Horses and chariots rolled over in wild confusion. Javelins were hurled, bows twanged, and the shouts of the combatants and the cries of the wounded as they fell beneath the feet of the struggling horses created a terrible din. Light and active, the Rebu footmen mingled in the fray, diving under the bellies of the Egyptian horses and inflicting vital stabs with their long knives, or engaging in hand-to-hand conflicts with the dismounted Egyptians. Amuba had charged down with the rest of the chariots. He was stationed in the second line immediately behind his father, and his charioteer Jethro, mindful of the orders he had received, strove, in spite of the angry orders of the lad, to keep the chariot stationary. But the horses were not to be restrained, and in spite of their driver's efforts, charged down the slope with the rest. Amuba, who had hunted lion and leopard, retained his coolness and discharged his arrows among the Egyptians with steady aim. For a time the contest was doubtful. Then 2,000 chosen men, the bodyguard of the Egyptian king, made their way across the swamp close to the causeway, and a mass of the heaviest chariots, drawn by the most powerful horses, forced their way across the causeway over all obstacles. In their midst was the king of Egypt himself, the great Thutmose. The weight and impetus of the mass of horses and chariots pressed all before it up the hill. This gave to the chariots which came on behind room to open to the right and left. The king's bodyguard shook the solid formation of the Rebu spearmen with their thick flights of arrows, and the chariots then dashed in among them. The Rebu fought with the valor of their race. The Egyptians who first charged among them fell pierced with their arrows, while their horses were stabbed in innumerable places. But as the stream of chariots poured over without a check, the infantry became broken up into groups, each fighting doggedly and desperately. The breaks which had occurred between the Rebu center and its two flanks had enabled the Egyptian bodyguard to thrust themselves through and fall upon the Rebu chariots and spearmen, who were still maintaining the desperate conflict. The Rebu king had throughout fought in the front line of his men, inspiring them with his voice and valor. But the weight of the attack was irresistible. The solid phalanx of Egyptian chariots pressed onward, and the Rebu were forced steadily back. Their chariots, enormously outnumbered, were destroyed rather than defeated. The horses fell, pierced by the terrible rain of arrows, and the wave of Egyptians passed over them. The king, looking round in his chariot, saw that all was lost, and that the only hope was to gain one or another of the masses of his infantry on the flank, and to lead them off the field in solid order. But as he turned to give orders, a shaft sent by a bowman in a chariot a few yards away struck him, and he fell back dead in his chariot.